That's the savings account I'm hoarding. Is there any sort of safety vault that could protect this account in the outside world? But what space do you have for moving forward? Where's your market? He chuckled. Market? I now work for use, not for profit. My use, not the looter's profit. Only those who add to my life, not those who devour it, are my market. Only those who produce, not those who consume, can ever be anybody's market. I deal with the life-givers, not with the cannibals. If my oil takes less effort to produce, I ask less of the men to whom I trade it for the things I need. I add an extra span of time to their lives with every gallon of my oil that they burn. And since they're men like me, they keep inventing faster ways to make the things they make, so every one of them gains me an added minute, hour, or day with the bread I buy from them, with the clothes, the lumber, the metal. He glanced at Galt. An added year with every month of electricity I purchase. That's our market, and that's how it works for us. But that was not the way it worked in the outer world. Down what drain were they poured out there? Our days, our lives, and our energy into what bottomless, featureless sewer of the unpaid for? Here we trade achievements, not failures, values, not needs. We're free of one another, yet we all grow together. Wealth, Dagny? What greater wealth is there than to own your life and to spend it on growing? Every living thing must grow. It can't stand still. It must grow or perish. Look, he pointed at a plant fighting upward from under the weight of a rock. A long, gnarled stem, contorted by an unnatural struggle, with drooping yellow remnants of unformed leaves, and a single green shoot thrust upward to the sun with the desperation of a last, spent, inadequate effort. That's what they're doing to us back there in hell. Do you see me submitting to it? No, she whispered. Do you see him submitting? He pointed at Galt. God, no. Then don't be astonished by anything you see in this valley. She remained silent when they drove on. Galt said nothing. On a distant mountainside in the dense green of a forest, she saw a pine tree slanting down suddenly, tracing a curve like the hand of a clock, then crashing abruptly out of sight. She knew that it was a man-made motion. Who's the lumberjack around here? She asked. Ted Nielsen. The road was relaxing into wider curves and gentler grades, among the softer shapes of hillsides. She saw a rust-brown slope patched by two squares of unmatching green, the dark, dusty green of potato plants, and the pale greenish silver of cabbages. A man in a red shirt was riding a small tractor cutting weeds. Who's the cabbage tycoon? She asked. Roger Marsh. She closed her eyes. She thought of the weeds that were climbing up the steps of a closed factory, over its lustrous tile front, a few hundred miles away beyond the mountains. The road was descending to the bottom of the valley. She saw the roofs of the town straight below, and the small shining spot of the dollar sign in the distance at the other end. Galt stopped the car in front of the first structure on a ledge above the roofs, a brick building with a faint tinge of red trembling over its smokestack. It almost shocked her to see so logical a sign as Stockton Foundry above its door. When she walked, leaning on her cane, out of the sunlight into the dank gloom of the building, the shock she felt was part sense of anachronism, part homesickness. This was the industrial East, which in the last few hours had seemed to be centuries behind her. This was the old, the familiar, the loved sight of reddish billows rising to steel rafters, of sparks shooting in sunbursts from invisible sources, of sudden flames streaking through a black fog, of sand molds glowing with white metal. The fog hid the walls of the structure, dissolving its size, and for a moment, this was the great, dead foundry at Stockton, Colorado. It was Nielsen Motors. It was Reardon Steel. Hi, Dagny. The smiling face that approached her out of the fog was Andrew Stockton's, and she saw a grimy hand extended to her with a gesture of confident pride, as if it held all of her moment's vision on its palm. She clasped the hand. Hello, she said softly, not knowing whether she was greeting the past or the future. Then she shook her head and added, How come you're not planting potatoes or making shoes around here? You've actually remained in your own profession? Oh, Calvin Atwood of the Atwood Light and Power Company of New York City is making the shoes. Besides, my profession is one of the oldest and the most immediately needed anywhere. Still, I had to fight for it. I had to ruin a competitor first. What? He grinned and pointed to the glass door of a sun-flooded room.
There's my ruined competitor, he said.
She saw a young man bent over a long table, working on a complex model for the mold of a drill head. He had the slender, powerful hands of a concert pianist, and the grim face of a surgeon concentrating on his task.
He's a sculptor, said Stockton. When I came here, he and his partner had a sort of combination hand forge and repair shop. I opened a real foundry and took all their customers away from them. The boy couldn't do the kind of job I did. It was only a part-time business for him anyway. Sculpture is his real business. So he came to work for me. He's making more money now in shorter hours than he used to make in his own foundry. His partner was a chemist, so he went into agriculture, and he's produced a chemical fertilizer that's doubled some of the crops around here. Did you mention potatoes? Potatoes in particular.
Then somebody could put you out of business, too.
Sure, any time. I know one man who could, and probably will when he gets here. But boy, I'd work for him as a cinder sweeper. He'd blast through this valley like a rocket. He'd triple everybody's production.
Who's that?
Hank Reardon.
Yes, she whispered. Oh, yes. She wondered what had made her say it with such immediate certainty. She felt simultaneously that Hank Reardon's presence in this valley was impossible, and that this was his place, peculiarly his. This was the place of his youth, of his start, and together the place he had been seeking all his life, the land he had struggled to reach, the goal of his tortured battle. It seemed to her that the spirals of flame-tinged fog were drawing time into an odd circle. And while a dim thought went floating through her mind like the streamer of an unfollowed sentence, to hold an unchanging youth is to reach at the end the vision with which one started. She heard the voice of a tramp in a diner saying, John Galt found the fountain of youth, which he wanted to bring down to men, only he never came back because he found that it couldn't be brought down. A sheaf of sparks went up in the depth of the fog, and she saw the broad back of a foreman whose arm made the sweeping gesture of a signal, directing some invisible task. He jerked his head to snap an order. She caught a glimpse of his profile, and she caught her breath. Stockton saw it, chuckled, and called into the fog.
Hey, Ken, come here. Here's an old friend of yours.
She looked at Ken Daniger as he approached them, the great industrialist whom she had tried so desperately to hold to his desk. Was now dressed in smudged overalls.
Hello, Miss Taggart. I told you we'd soon meet again.
Her head dropped as if in assent and in greeting, but her hand bore down heavily upon her cane for a moment while she stood reliving their last encounter, the tortured hour of waiting, then the gently distant face at the desk and the tinkling of a glass-paneled door closing upon a stranger. It was so brief a moment that two of the men before her could take it only as a greeting. But it was at Galt that she looked when she raised her head, and she saw him looking at her as if he knew what she felt. She saw him seeing in her face the realization that it was he who had walked out of Daniger's office that day. His face gave her nothing in answer. It had that look of respectful severity with which a man stands before the fact that the truth is the truth. I didn't expect it, she said softly to Daniger. I never expected to see you again. Daniger was watching her as if she were a promising child he had once discovered, and was now affectionately amused to watch.
I know, he said. But why are you so shocked?
Oh, it's just that it's preposterous. She pointed at his clothes.
What's wrong with it?
Is this then the end of your road?
Hell no, the beginning.
What are you aiming at?
Mining. Not coal, though. Iron.
Where?
He pointed toward the mountains. Right here. Did you ever know Midas Mulligan to make a bad investment? You'd be surprised what one can find in that stretch of rock if one knows how to look. That's what I've been doing. Looking.
And if you don't find any iron ore?
He shrugged. There's other things to do. I've always been short on time in my life, never on what to use it for.
She glanced at Stockton with curiosity. Aren't you training a man who could become your most dangerous competitor?
That's the only sort of men I like to hire, Dagny. Have you lived too long among the looters? Have you come to think that one man's ability is a threat to another?
Oh, no.
But I thought I was almost the only one left who didn't think that. Any man who's afraid of hiring the best ability he can find is a cheat who's in a business where he doesn't belong. To me, the foulest man on earth, more contemptible than a criminal, is the employer who rejects men for being too good. That's what I've always thought, and... Say, what are you laughing at?